24-2441, Northern Iowa, United States versus Alexander Ledvina.
All right, good morning, gentlemen. Mr. LaHammer, the court appreciates your willingness to accept the appointment in this case under the Criminal Justice Act, and you may proceed when ready.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'm Michael LaHammer on behalf of Alexander Ledvina in this case. Mr. Ledvina was charged with an unlawful user in possession of a firearm, as well as false statements on an ATF form. Shortly after being charged, he filed a motion to dismiss, challenging the constitutionality of the Second Amendment. The court denied it on its face and said that it would not rule on any as-applied challenge absent a trial. Mr. Ledvina did go to trial. Much like having a jury, all those rights are implicated. He stipulated to a bench trial with negotiated facts. The defense negotiated with the government, and that brings us, he was found guilty, and that brings us to where we're at today with his appeal. Essentially, disarming drug users because they are so drug users is inconsistent with the Second Amendment. I believe that's where the case law stands right now. And that's the key issue in this case, one of three, whether these statutes are unconstitutional as applied to Mr. Ledvina based on Beasley, Deng, and Cooper, as well as Cordova-Perez, more recently decided. The government concedes, essentially, Beasley holds that an as-applied challenge depends on whether a defendant's drug use makes him dangerous to others. These are generalized arguments by the government. Beasley, Deng, and Cooper find that the drug use must render the defendant equivalent to a mentally ill person who could be disarmed historically. Cordova-Perez even talks
Just to correct you, there's two other possibilities. The Rahimi credible danger and going armed laws were also analogies.
Thank you, Judge. I appreciate that. Cordova-Perez added they must show that he has lost his reason as well, and that was recently. And in this case, there's no evidence in the record that Ledvina's occasional drug use made him mentally ill to that extent. The government argues dangerousness, and there's simply no evidence of that in the record in this case.
But you agree, you know, just to kind of put the matter on the ground here, that if he does pose if they prove that he poses a credible danger, that he can be disarmed under the, I think that was my Cooper decision.
I believe that credible danger is no different than terror, the terror language
very
that the
similar.
Court has used. I think it all falls into the same umbrella, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The government's argument that it is generalized, armed drug dealers are dangerous to others. Beasley and Cooper require an individual analysis of whether Mr. Ledvina's drug use specifically made him dangerous to others. Not enough for them to show he possessed a firearm while using controlled substances. They must show his use of the controlled substances coupled with possession of the firearm caused him to be dangerous.
And why couldn't he be disarmed just as a habitual drug user, like habitual drunkards historically were imprisoned or subject to sureties?
I don't think the case law supports that, Your Honor. I think that the case law says you have to have an individualized assessment and not a general category that people
can
follow.
Well, the Perez case says it's an open question whether categorical prohibition is constitutional, and there's a specific footnote that says we have no occasion to address the habitual issue that I just mentioned. You're aware of that, right?
I am aware of that, and we are arguing that a more specified finding by the court is an individual analysis.
But why? Why is that required?
Well, because you generally, say an habitual drunkard, are they drunk 24/7? Are they demonstrating an actual danger to others. I don't think the drunkenness in and of itself makes a person prohibited. I think you have to find that.
But if historically drunkards were detained or subject to sureties for a period of time, even during times when they weren't still drunk, why wouldn't it follow that it's permissible to regulate beyond the actual moment of intoxication or drug intoxication? Yeah.
Well, Judge, I think you said it. For a period of time, they were locked up. For a period of time. And that is a period of time where it's determined that they're dangerous. And that has to be shown in each case. And we're asking that the court find that the government has failed in this case. The evidence is simply not sufficient at the bench trial to show that he was a danger.
Well, and of course, you know, the other answer is that Veasley addresses that directly. The initial one on facial challenges, it says that it explored intoxication over about 7 or 8 pages and said ultimately, yeah, they just didn't disarm people who were drunk. And so that kind of, I guess, answers the question.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Now, there was some evidence at trial about Mr. Levina having a firearm when they were executing a search warrant, and he reached down at the floorboard. They did find a loaded firearm. The district court found that he was disarming himself when we appealed the detention order in this case. It wasn't an issue of dangerousness. He obviously was not dangerous, recognizing that officers were present executing a search warrant and disarmed himself.
Well, so now I want to ask you about the comparison to Perez, because now you're getting into that territory. So Perez was arguably more dangerous, and they remanded there. I mean, there were several incidents. In fact, the opinion goes to great length to talk about the prior incidents and says, look, in the end, there was no individualized assessment, so we have to send it back down under Cooper. Mm-hmm. But here we do have an incident, at least one incident. We have an incident where he went in and put a gun, I think, in the face of a neighbor when he was he knocking on a door or something like that? And maybe that's for the district court to decide, but I just wonder whether that shows a credible threat of being dangerous or of danger, the Rahimi standard.
Well, I think two parts of that, Judge. Number one is I think that was sentencing evidence and not trial evidence. And I don't believe remand is possible in this case. Cooper didn't address it. And what we're saying, this is a sufficiency of evidence argument. The government failed. They don't get two bites at the apple.
So that your point is even though they presented this evidence during sentencing, they couldn't present it on remand, even though at the time the district court didn't know about Cooper or Veasley or Perez or any of these cases.
Well, the judge did hold a bench trial prior to sentencing and ruled on it prior to sentencing with evidence, no different than had he gone to a jury trial and the jury found certain evidence. In this case,
why can't the court consider evidence that came in at sentencing on the constitutional question?
You don't have protections under the Constitution at sentencing that you do at a trial. And if it's a sufficiency of the evidence argument.
Well, are you saying that the constitutional question has to be tried like a jury issue?
I believe that's an option if it were to go to that route to be remanded, yes. I'd like to reserve my time.
Just really quickly, could the district court hold an evidentiary? I mean, Perez opens up the possibility of, I think it's a some other proceeding. I don't remember the exact language, so I'm paraphrasing. You don't think that could come up at the some other proceeding in Perez?
I do not. I think Cooper didn't argue the double jeopardy, and we have submitted it to the court. Thank you.
Mr. Vanderstoep, we'll hear from you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Adam Vanderstoep. I represent the United States government, and I'm with the U.S. Attorney's Office in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. This court's two recent cases in Cooper and Perez are the two cases that lay out the questions that need to be answered in determining whether or not an as-applied challenge under Bruin can be successful to
Section 922 G3. Specifically, most recently in Perez, the two questions that were asked is whether the defendant's marijuana use caused him to act like someone who is both mentally ill and dangerous, or whether the defendant's marijuana use would or did make him induce terror or pose a credible threat to the physical safety of others with a firearm. There was also the third avenue, as Your Honor has already previously mentioned, that potential categorical approach of categorical disarmament of individuals who pose a special risk of danger considering misuse of firearms. In the record in this case, there are three separate occasions when the defendant was acting dangerously with a firearm. First was on August 11, 2022, when he was encountered by law enforcement investigators pursuant to their execution of the search warrant. That information is contained in the stipulation of fact. It's at paragraph 8. In that case, when he was approached by law enforcement, he was in his vehicle. He was asked to show his hands. He did not comply with law enforcement, but he kept reaching down and looking down towards the floorboard of his vehicle. Eventually, when he did get out of the vehicle, he did not place the vehicle in park, resulting in the vehicle having to start moving backwards, and an officer had to jump in, put the vehicle in park, and a firearm was located in the area where the defendant was seen reaching down and looking down.
Was he, you know, I was looking through the record, maybe you could argue it by implication, but was there evidence that he was actually on drugs at that particular point in time?
Your Honor, the stipulation also states that the defendant had urine sample taken from him the day of the search warrant on August 11, 2022, and the urine tested positive for two cocaine metabolites and one metabolite for THC. Additionally, in the vehicle, this is also in the stipulations, there was a partially smoked cannabis roach that was in the front ashtray in front of the shifter area, as well as a baggie of cannabis inside the vehicle as well. That is the evidence showing that during that time period that he was a user of marijuana. Additionally, the stipulation is going to show that he admits that he was consistently using marijuana during the period of August of 2022.
I'm going to ask you sort of a variation of the same question I asked opposing counsel. So I think Perez is one of those cases where when it goes down to the district court is highly likely to find that there was a credible threat of danger. There's a lot of evidence there, at least according to what the majority panel decision said. How does this case compare in your view? You're talking about why he's dangerous. How does this case compare to the record we had in Perez?
Your Honor, my understanding of the facts of Perez was it was a methamphetamine buy bust that was supposed to happen, and I believe there was a car chase. Law enforcement eventually stopped the vehicle. There was methamphetamine in the vehicle, and the guy made admissions that I ran away because I was scared. I was pretty high, and I think he had like a baggie of marijuana on his person or something like that. Yeah. Ultimately, in this case, I think there's more of the individualized nature of dangerousness for Mr. Ledvina. I will note, just to preserve the record, it's still the government's position that habitual drug users can be categorically prohibited and disarmed. However, I understand that Cooper and Perez are currently the law in the Eighth Circuit, acknowledging that Perez does seem to leave open the door for some sort of categorical disarmament. But here in this case, I believe there's more in the evidence, more in the record that Ledvina is a danger.
Well, on that issue on the habitual drunkard, that's the government's position by the SG in the Fifth Circuit case. It's currently pending for cert. They did not seek, they sought a hold, I believe, in Cooper in light of the Fifth Circuit case.
That is correct, Your Honor. Yeah. The petition that the government filed in the Hamani case lays out the habitual drunkard and goes through the historical analogs about
that. And that's the government's position on the statute. And
that is correct.
Perez says that's an open question. So you urge us to adopt that here in this case?
Yes, Your Honor. Yep, that is the government's position on these 922 G3 cases. And then Cooper, I believe Daniels, and I believe there might be another case as well that's currently a writ for certiorari with the Supreme Court, are being asked to be held pending the resolution of the Hamani case.
But you do agree that Veasley goes into great depth on the intoxication/habitual drunkard.
Yes, Your Honor. I understand that Veasley did the analysis, and again, preserving the government's argument, the government disagrees with.
Yeah, where does Veasley talk about habitual drunkards?
Your Honor, I believe, and Judge Strauss, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe you're talking about the intoxication.
Correct.
Where habitual drunkards.
That's a different point then, right? Since Perez says Cooper left open the possibility of other analogs and says we don't address habitual drunkards.
That is correct, Your Honor. Perez does leave open the categorical approach for the habitual users. And I do know in the...
But intoxication would presumably include habitual intoxication as well. Or at least that would be the fair reading of Veasley.
I can see that argument, whether or not intoxication in the analog analysis that this court did in Veasley encompasses everything that the Solicitor General's office did in the Hamani petition. I don't know if that's necessarily true because the Hamani
petition... The problem with that argument is that was argued in Veasley, and that was Veasley's response to it. It was argued that habitual drunkards are disarmed, and that was the way the court dealt with that. So that was squarely presented and squarely dealt with in Veasley.
You know, one of the things about habitual drunkards and habitual drug users is that there's some brain chemistry things that go on with addiction that continue to be going on when you are apparently stone cold sober, right? Because habitual use of both stimulants and depressants leaves you in a position where the brain synapse pathways actually change and are modified, and it doesn't go snap right back like a rubber band, you know, when you get sober. That's why it takes a period of 6 months to 18 months for people of continuous sobriety for people's thinking to clear, right? In common law, habitual drunkards were deprived of certain rights, and they were deprived of them even when they were stone cold sober, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Right, and they didn't have knowledge of the brain chemistry that we have now.
Science has greatly advanced since then, so I would agree with that, Your Honor.
And so, what's your strongest case for saying that a marijuana user is similar in kind and nature to a habitual drunkard at common law, such that they could be categorically precluded from possession of a firearm?
Well, Your Honor, marijuana, increased habitual use of marijuana on an individual will have cognitive effects on the individual, the same way alcohol does. And I know you asked specifically about marijuana. What I don't want to get lost, I guess, in the record of this case is Mr. Levina was also a consistent cocaine user as well. And he actually admitted that he was frequently using cocaine, as was also evidenced by the cocaine metabolites being present in his urine at the time of the search warrant.
On that point, was there any evidence, though, and this is to Judge Erickson's point, was there any evidence of how, I know marijuana metabolites can stay in your system for up to 30 days. I've seen that in a previous case. Any idea how long cocaine metabolites stay in your system, or do the levels show that he had just had either or both of those substances?
So in the stipulation, Your Honor, we, defense counsel and I, were working through this issue, and I believe, if I can find it on this page, it talks about, so it's paragraph 10 of the stipulation, which is page 5, and based on conversations, the defendant used cocaine sometime between August 8, 2021 and August 11, 2021. Now, it's not explicitly in the record, but that was based off of, I believe, the general consensus. Again, this is not record, but cocaine stays in your system for, I believe, 36 hours.
Okay.
I believe. I'm using my memory. I could be wrong.
So you said August 11 to 14. Just to nail this down, I can't remember exactly when the incident was where the car backed up and the...
That was August 11, Your Honor.
Oh, okay.
So he admitted sometime between August 8 and August 11.
I see.
He had used cocaine, and that's the reason why there were the cocaine metabolites in his urine.
I understand. Thank you for the clarification.
I know I'm running out of time. There are a few other things I want to hit. There are two other instances in the record pertaining to defendant's dangerousness with firearms. One of them, as was previously mentioned, was back in April in 2022. He went to one of his drug customers' residences and knocked on the door to collect a drug debt. There were two neighbors who were standing outside. This upset the defendant. He pulled a firearm and pointed it at them. The stipulations also show that during this same period, April of 2022, he still admits that he is using marijuana 5 to 6 times per week. Additionally, the individual was called to testify at sentencing whose door he was knocking on and recounted a time where they were at the defendant's residence doing cocaine together and the defendant accidentally discharged a firearm. Again, three separate counts or three different instances of dangerousness. Finally, the one other thing, I dropped my piece of paper, but just to make clear here, I noticed in the defendant's reply brief, he argues for the first time that 924A1A is unconstitutional under the Second Amendment. That argument was not made in the district court, That argument was not made in the initial reply brief or the initial brief by the defendant or the pro se brief. That argument, the Second Amendment challenge to 924A1A, is not properly before this court. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you for your argument. We'll hear rebuttal.
Just very briefly, Your Honors, I appreciate the limited time I have available left. Judge Strauss, you asked about the metabolites in the urine. Marijuana, typically 30 days. Cocaine, 48 to 72 hours, 2 to 3 days. And in this case, the stipulation was 8-8 to 8-11, a three-day period. It still needs to go to, did the intoxication or the drug use cause the dangerous activity?
That's a question, but wouldn't you agree that they've at least established, maybe I'm wrong about this, they've at least established he was on drugs during the period when the car rolled back and they stopped him and all that stuff, or am I wrong about that?
You are wrong about that, okay. Judge, only in respect with you can use drugs and after the effects of the drugs are over, still test positive in the case of marijuana for up to 30 days. Well, the high doesn't last 30 days, same with cocaine, 2 to 3 days. The high doesn't last for that period of time. And we would also submit the record at trial in this case is only the search warrant incident where he disarmed himself, the car rolled, it had nothing to do with a firearm, the car rolling, of course. And then the as-applied challenge is not resolved after a guilty plea. There was some case law we did cite, Baxter, Lofton, and Grubb, which also we submit supports our arguments that this is a sufficiency of the evidence appeal, and the government has not held their burden or kept their burden, and we would ask that the case be dismissed. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you for your argument. The case is submitted, and the court will file an opinion in due course.